Every outlet, every narrative, every news source is driven by fear. Fear is the world's native tongue, and we're left with two choices: attack or avoid. But what if there's always been a third option? Love. A radical, countercultural, courageous love.
Well, hello everyone. Great to see you today. I'm glad you're with us. Hey, listen, processed food is a huge problem in our country. First of all, it's everywhere. It's readily available. It's inexpensive compared to most clean foods. And so no wonder it's a problem for us. And processed just means that ingredients have been added, like sugar and salt, artificial flavors, preservatives, to make the food more appealing and to make it last longer. And so our palate responds to salt and sugar and fat. And so these foods feed our appetite and our addiction for tasty little morsels. I heard Dr. Bradley Garrett saying recently that the same thing is happening with social media. It's processed information. And like processed food, it's everywhere. It's readily available. It's highly addictive. And for example, the makers of Twitter consulted with slot machine designers to figure out what keeps people pulling the lever. And so Twitter could have just had the feed refresh itself, but instead you go to the top and you pull down the top of your screen like a little lever, and it makes a noise, and voila, more tweets appear. And processed information is the most addictive kind. So information needs three simple ingredients to get us hooked. First, it has to be easy to understand. In other words, really oversimplified. 140 characters or less, perfect. It allows for no nuance, no context, just quick hits. The second ingredient is that it demonizes someone. So the most popular information to consume is the stuff where there's a clear bad guy. And the third ingredient is that it gives you a sense of belonging when you read it. It locates you in a tribe, a place where you and your ideas feel at home. And so these ingredients, you know, we want this quick hit that's oversimplified, it demonizes someone, and it makes us feel belonging to our side. And so pull the lever and refresh and get more of it, and we're like rabid junkies. Just like our taste buds want salt and sugar and fat, social media is preying on our basic human needs and addictive nature. And you can see by this formula why a huge percentage of social media interaction ends with people furious at each other, insulting and angry and driven further and further into a divide over politics or religion or race or COVID or sports or masks or whatever is the issue of the day. And if people talk to each other in real life, like they talk to each other on social media, hospitals would be full of people with broken noses. Like, we'd have to flatten that curve, right? So social media, it's kind of like road rage. Like, you can use the space between you to treat the person in the other car like a monster. You can dehumanize them, you can isolate them, you can make up stories about why they're so stupid because you've never actually had to talk to them. And road rage intensifies the faster your little tin can on wheels is going down the road because you're amped up, your senses are heightened, which is also part of our polarization problem now on social media. Like, we're in the midst of a pandemic, there's a lockdown, there's racial unrest, there's riots in the streets, we're heading into maybe the most contentious presidential election of our lifetime. There's economic instability, unprecedented joblessness. Our kids can't go to school normally. They can't play sports. College football is canceled. Like, lots of people are feeling hopeless. And so we're already amped up. It's like driving a car at 70 miles an hour. And as a result, when we get that processed, overly simplified information that comes at you and someone is demonized and dehumanized and you feel like you're part of a cause to make things right, like, it's infuriating. And you're probably going to make some bad decisions in that frame of mind. You're probably going to make some enemies, which is why this month we thought it would be really good for us to take a closer look at Jesus' approach to the way we interact with those that we disagree with. And I got some really nice messages and cards recently saying, hey, Derek, you know, you must be really ticking a lot of people off with this series, so we thought you could use some encouragement. So yes and yes, thank you for that. But this approach to loving enemies was not my idea. It was Jesus' idea, so blame him and Dan White, okay? We've been using Dan's great book, Love Over Fear, as our jumping off point. So Jesus presses us again and again to choose love for the other over fear. And today I'm honored to bring the series to a close with a message titled Compassionate Curiosity. It corresponds with chapter 8 in the book if you're reading along. And here's the big idea. Curiosity helps to coax a heart out of hiding. Last week, we discussed this idea that one of the biggest barriers that we face when trying to relate to people we disagree with is called the expert delusion. And the expert delusion just says, I already know that person or that group of people because I know facts about them. Like I watched a YouTube video, I read a Facebook post, and so I have all the generalized knowledge about that person and their kind. Right? And so this delusion erodes our ability to enter into the experience of another. It tricks us into thinking that we know everything about them because I'm informed. And so by the time we encounter that person, our minds are already made up about them. We have that person pegged without ever talking to them. We think, you know, if I know their political or religious or moral views from afar, then that means I know them. This is also called prejudice. Or prejudging, and it feeds our tendency to make monsters out of people. And so we'll believe things like, well, all Muslims are violent, all conservatives are white supremacists, all liberals are communists, all rich people are corrupt, all black people are angry. Whatever it is, the expert delusion tricks us into thinking that we know what someone is like without ever talking to them. But Jesus modeled a different approach to knowing others. He showed us that instead, That knowing someone is a learning process that occurs through relationships, even people we may be repelled by. Jesus told us not only to love each other and to love our neighbor, but also to love our enemy. Love the person we want to commit social media road rage against. And so we said last week, to begin to do the work of love, we need to make space. And instead of filling the gap between us with assumptions about that person and stories we make up in our head, that we need to fill the gap with affection. And we have to create some space for love to come to town. Maybe that looks like a meal, which Jesus used so often as a bridge-building tool, or a cup of coffee, or an email, or a FaceTime call. And today I want to talk about what to do once you create some space. Like if you're able to sit down with someone you disagree with or are politically opposed to, how should you approach that time? And I think the key is compassionate curiosity. And to understand this, I want you to understand something about Jesus. Because just like you may have been surprised last week that the Bible actually says that Jesus came eating and drinking, he used meals as one of his ministry strategies. You might also be surprised at another one of his methods. He had a reputation for asking a lot of questions. And so the Gospels record Jesus asking some 307 questions. He was a consummate question asker. Jesus used these short, simple questions to create a connection and to draw people in, even the most unsuspecting people. So in the Gospel of Matthew, for example, he frequently asked his disciples, "What do you think?" On the road to the village of Emmaus, the resurrected Jesus asked two men that he comes upon on the road, "What are you discussing together as you walk?" When he takes his disciples through Samaria and he stops at a well, he asks the lone woman, "Will you get me a drink?" He comes across a blind man named Bartimaeus, and he asks, "What do you want me to do for you?" Like later, before entering Jerusalem to face his death, he asks his disciples one of the most significant questions ever posed, "Who do the people say that I am?" And then when they give a somewhat unequivocal answer, he turns to Peter and he demands, "But who do you say that I am?" Now remember, Jesus already knew all the answers to these questions. But he also knew that spiritual curiosity can coax the heart out of hiding. It can give people room to grow. And so when we go into conversations with someone we disagree with, we often think it's important to have all the answers. Like I wonder if that's simply an exercise in sharpening the wrong weapon. We want to make the answers the point. Because what Christians need to remember is that when it comes to loving others, it's more important to ask the right questions than to have all the answers. And it's interesting to see how Jesus answered questions in those same Gospels. So, he asked 307 questions, but he was asked 183 questions. And do you want to guess how many of those questions he was asked he gave a straight answer to? 4. He answered only 4 of the 183 questions directly. And often his answers to people's questions was just to ask them another question right back. And so in an age when having all the answers is glorified, when a great guest on CNN is someone who can spew 30 concrete answers to the world's problems in 90 seconds, like we should probably wonder, why is it that the one person who actually knows all the answers, Jesus, why is he asking so many questions? Because in most Christian circles, we feel such pressure to always have the right answers for everyone. And unfortunately, that pressure can lead us to become unintended pretenders, where we end up pretending like we have all of life figured out when we still have lots of questions ourselves. It might be part of the reason that so many of us are seen as hypocrites. So I want to look at the curiosity of Jesus. This word curious comes from a Latin word that means careful. To be curious is to believe that everyone should be treated with carefulness. And Jesus used curiosity to demonstrate care to people all the time. So in our world of polarization of left and right and cancel culture, compassionate curiosity is an act of defiance. People don't want to ask questions. It's too vulnerable a position. It means, I don't know everything. We just want answers because guess what? When we find an answer, we don't have to think about it anymore. It's done, it's settled, and frankly, it's just easier. But I want to look at the curiosity of Jesus. And so our story today is in John 5, 2 through 8. And it starts this way. Now there is in Jerusalem, near the Sheep Gate, a pool, which in Aramaic is called Bethesda, and which is surrounded by 5 covered colonnades. Here, a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, the paralyzed. One who was there had been an invalid for 38 years. All right, I want to stop right there and set the stage for a minute. Our setting is a pool. It's near the Sheep Gate called, and the pool is called Bethesda, which means House of Grace. Now, I love the detail of the Sheep Gate because it for a couple reasons. One, it was a place where shepherds would come into the city and they would stop and wash their animals in the pool. But that also means that people probably would have stopped there on their way to offering sacrifices to watch their sacrificial sheep and lambs in this pool, which is a little gross when you think about it, but it gives the story a kind of a gritty biblical realism. Like you can almost see it and smell the animals and the hay and the straw in the air. But I also love it because it places the pool geographically in the city. And for many, many years, some historians said that the pool never existed. This was a reason, they said, to believe that the Bible was made up, just fairy tales, and they chalked it up to further proof as to why John's gospel isn't reliable. But in 1988, archaeologists found the ruins of this pool, and it was right there where John said it was. In fact, further excavations showed it to be exactly as John described it in our text. There's a church that sits next to it now called the Church of St. Anne, and you can visit if you go there to Jerusalem today. But it's just another in a long string of attempts to discredit the Bible, that when all the facts come out, the Bible is actually proved to be historically accurate. Now, there was something else about this pool. There was a kind of urban legend associated with it. It's not biblical, but it was believed to have magical healing powers in the culture of the day. In fact, if you're looking at your Bible right now at John 5, you'll notice that there's probably no verse 4. It just goes from verse 3 to verse 5. Verse 4 was removed, and it was a verse that explained all about this urban legend that an angel would come and disturb the water. But this verse was not in the earliest manuscripts. It was added later by a well-meaning scribe, and so it's been removed from our modern copies. Another attention to detail that I think demonstrates the integrity with which the Bible comes to us. There was not an angel stirring up the water. But there actually was a subterranean stream or an artesian well under the pool. And every now and then, the stream bubbled up and disturbed the surface, maybe once a year or once every other year. And the urban legend said that the first sick person to get into the pool after the water was disturbed would be healed. And this legend drew huge crowds, so many crowds that the Romans had roofed colonnades built to provide shelter for all the sick people who were waiting for the magic water to be disturbed. And here we have a man who had been afflicted for 38 years, which, by the way, was longer than the average lifespan at the time. He had probably been brought to this pool by his parents as a boy. And at some point, they gave up on the magic trick, but he stayed. This was his only hope. And so can you imagine how many races to the bubbling pool he had lost over the decades? He was probably born with deformed legs, or perhaps as an infant, he was the victim of an accident. But his condition, and then this awful competition, was all that he knew. It had become his whole world until Jesus showed up. Look at verse 6. It says, when Jesus saw him lying there and learned that he had been in this condition for a long time, he asked him, "Do you want to get well?" "Sir," the invalid replied, "I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. While I'm trying to get in, someone else goes down ahead of me." And then Jesus said, "Get up, pick up your mat and walk." And at once the man was cured. He picked up his mat and walked. Now, there are so many lessons here in this text about, one, how we're prone to look elsewhere other than Jesus, even to superstitions and wives' tales for our healing, when true healing only comes through Jesus. Or how we see here this incredible sovereignty of God when Jesus does a miracle, even though there's no mention of faith or belief on the man's part. Jesus just walks up, he knows about his story, and he heals him, and he heals him completely. Or the fact that the main reason for the placement of this story here in John's gospel is that it sets off a huge dispute with the Pharisees in the coming chapters about healing on the Sabbath, and really establishes Jesus as greater than all the Old Testament ceremonial laws and purification laws. And so there are a bunch of places this passage could take us. But today, I want to zero in on the question in verse 6. Jesus asked the man, "Do you want to get well?" And at face value, it seems so obvious that it's almost bordering on rude. Like, does Jesus need sensitivity training here? Well, why did he ask that? What's the deal with the question? Well, Jesus knows what we stated in our big idea today, that curiosity coaxes the heart out of hiding. And I think part of the reason that he asks is because Jesus understands the dynamics of being enslaved to something for a long time, a disability, an addiction, a frame of mind. He understood that it's possible for something to keep you down for so long that you don't even want to get up anymore. Like, you can be chained up for so long that you forget what it feels like to want to be free. And so Jesus asked him quite seriously, "Do you want to get well? Do you want a change? Do you want a breakthrough? Do you want to be freed?" Because some people don't. Some of you are so comfortable with mediocrity and dysfunction that you think it's normal. Some of you don't want God to deliver you from your temper and your rage because it's a tool that anger, you've used it successfully for so long to manipulate people and get what you want. Some of you don't want to get well from your materialism because it's become like Novocaine for you and you don't know what you'd do without it. You enjoy numbing your stress by running up your credit card, getting boxes at the door. Some of you don't want delivered from your alcoholism. It's the only coping mechanism you know. And so I think it's a question we all need to face. Do you want to be healed? Do you really want to get out of this? Do you want to get well? Jesus knows that you won't change what you're willing to tolerate. So he asks. And remember, Jesus is omniscient. And so when he asks questions like this, his purpose isn't for him to get some new information that he doesn't already know. He's demonstrating compassionate curiosity. He's engaging because he wants us to acknowledge and work through what he already understands. He's giving space for the man to reflect and to consider where he finds himself. And so Jesus' question, coupled with the man's response, leads to a powerful healing. I believe this same compassionate curiosity could lead to a lot of healing in our day as well. I'm convinced that if you and I would imitate the curiosity of Jesus, that it could lead to healing in your relationships. It could lead to healing in your marriage, healing in the way you interact with those you disagree with. It can be a critical skill upon which we build this radical love of the other that Jesus called us to so frequently. And so I want us to look at the story again and learn from Jesus through a curiosity lens. Because once you make up your mind that you will not live in fear of your enemies, you start to realize that our culture has trained our muscles in the boxing gym of defense and debate and destroy. We're conditioned to dig in our heels and to throw a good verbal punch. If someone insults us, we insult back. If someone is snarky, we snark back. If they hate us, we hate back. And we need to grow new muscles for loving people. And one of them is curiosity. And so I want to look at three keys to compassionate curiosity. Here's the first one. It's just a slow down. Did you ever notice that Jesus was very busy, but he was never in a hurry? And so this miracle begins with Jesus noticing. Look at verse 6. Jesus saw him lying there, and he learned that he had been in this condition for a long time. Notice those two verbs. He saw the man, and he learned his story. Jesus was in the process of saving all of humanity, and he slowed down enough to save this one man. So when it comes to our ability to show love, speed kills. We need to stop and we need to learn. Yet we run around fast-paced and exhausted all the time. And for the Christian, exhaustion is the enemy of our faith, and it's the enemy of our relationships. The great danger for most Christians is not that we will renounce our faith. It is that we will become so distracted and rushed and preoccupied that we will settle for a mediocre version of it. And that's the case when it comes to the love of the other, love for enemy. It's impossible to do just about anything the way that Jesus did it, in a hurry. You can't love in a hurry. You can't listen to a child in a hurry. You can't go deep with God in a hurry. We need to slow down. And when you slow down, you'll start to notice things you never saw before. You know, we have a beautiful natural resource here in Erie called Presque Isle. It's a fantastic peninsula that juts out into the lake with 11 beaches and bike paths and walking trails, plant and animal and marine life everywhere. And so back when we could fly in airplanes, I always enjoyed the little puddle jumper flight from Detroit to Erie at the end of a trip. Because during that final approach into Erie, the plane would often bank out around and over the peninsula. And you can see the trees and the beaches and the little disturbance in the water from the boats. It's a beautiful view. But I want you to contrast that with driving your car around the peninsula, that 13-mile loop or whatever it is. And you see Presque Isle a little differently. You can see, you know, the high water level approaching the sidewalks. You can see people packing and unpacking their cars with all the beach gear. But now, if you get out of your car and you actually ride your bike around the path, you'll notice different things. You'll see the faces of joggers and moms pushing their baby in a stroller. You'll get snippets of a conversation from one fisherman to another. You'll see the sailboats in the bay skimming across the top of the water. But then if you'll stop and sit on the beach, just sit in one place, you'll be able to observe a deeper level of detail. You can see the contours of the beach glass around you. You can smell the lake. Kim and I experienced the whole engagement photo shoot the other night as two fiancés sauntered through the shallow water, young and in love. You can see the shades of orange and pink and purple in the sunset. And so what's my point? What's the difference in those four scenarios, plane to car to bike to sitting? Well, the difference is speed and proximity. The more you slow down and the more you get close, the more details you'll observe. And the same is true in our relationships. If you slow down and get close and take notice, you're gonna get a lot more details. And I'm afraid a lot of us are flying airplanes in our relationships, like we're buzzing the control tower when it comes to the people in our lives. And so the first step toward compassionate curiosity is just slowing down enough to notice and listen and to care like Jesus did with this man. But there's a second key. And it's to lead with questions. Again, Jesus could have started this interaction in a lot of different ways. He could have preached a sermon. He could have given advice. He could have diagnosed the reason for the man's disability. He could have made him declare faith. Instead, Jesus did what he did so often. He asked a question. He said, "Do you want to get well?" And so the first cousin to curiosity is asking questions. And truly curious people don't just stop at the surface questions. They take the time to peel back the onion until they understand. I remember when I was a little kid, we would go to our family functions down in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where my mom's family's from. And I had five aunts and uncles on that side and all kinds of cousins running around. And my uncle Ron, he would always seek me out. And I loved it. He was genuinely interested in me. He was a great question asker, and he would lean in, he would look me in the eye, and he would keep asking deeper and deeper follow-up questions. And it wasn't to interrogate, it was in genuine interest, below the surface stuff. And so it would start with, "Hey, how's football practice going?" And I would tell him. And then it was, "Well, what's unique about your team this year?" And then, "What is it about football that draws you to it?" And then, "What are some of the life lessons you're learning from your teammates?" And then, "What are some of the qualities that you admire about your coaches?" And he would lovingly and patiently coax my heart out of hiding and get a 15-year-old to think about life a little differently. I loved it. Those of you who know Pastor John from Grace Harbor Creek, John's a great question asker. And the end result is that whenever you're in the presence of someone like Pastor John or my Uncle Ron, you feel valued, you feel important. Barriers are being broken down with every sentence. Your heart starts to come out of its shell a little bit more. And these days, there may be some of you here who have asked more questions to electronics than you have to actual people in the last week. Like, it's not uncommon to ask Google anything. "Hey, Google, why don't dogs have belly buttons?" Or, "Hey, Siri, you know, where are my keys?" Or, "Hey, Alexa, how do you know when milk has curdled?" Or whatever. We need to be asking questions of people instead of robots, because in our world of polarization, curiosity is an act of total rebellion. It puts you in this position of vulnerability. Questions force us to give up control because you have no idea what kind of answer you're going to get. Questions give power away to the other person. It places us at their feet, humbly moving beyond the stereotypes. After all, we can't discover someone's story if we've already determined their narrative. And so polarization feeds us the information. It says, that person is anti-American. That person's anti-woman. They're pro-rapist. They're ignorant. They're thugs. They're anti-science. They're homophobes. Our culture force feeds us the labels. It categorizes. It fills in all the blanks so that we no longer have to be curious about each other. But questions, on the other hand, questions create space for understanding. They make it available for love to take up residence. But it can't stop at just asking good questions. The third key is this. We need to learn to listen. So in verse 7 of our text, Jesus lets the man respond. And the man essentially says, I have no one to help me. That's why I haven't been healed. I have no one to help me. And so Jesus listens and he responds. And he shows him, I'm here to help you in a totally different way than you were expecting. It has nothing to do with the water. It has to do with me. And we've become notoriously bad listeners. Listening is another lost art. Our society says that power comes from talking, declaring, making statements. One researcher reports that on average, people spend 60% of conversations talking about themselves. That figure jumps to 80% when we're on social media. And there's a dopamine effect. We get a neurological buzz when we talk about ourselves. It's why it's so hard to resist the urge to when we're in a conversation, to turn the conversation back to me, to try to one-up the other person's story. But we need more people who are willing to say, what about you? Instead of, let me tell you about me. As Dan says in his book, I've learned that being interested is much more enjoyable than my attempts to appear interesting. So I'm reminded of the old saying that you have two ears and one mouth for a reason, so you can listen twice as much as you speak. James 1:19 and 20 comes to mind, where James says, everyone should be quick to listen and slow to speak and slow to become angry, because human anger does not produce the righteousness that God desires. Man, we could chalk that one up these days. Be a good listener. Get to know a person's story. Listen with eye contact. Be sensitive to them and to the Holy Spirit as you listen. Follow up by asking them clarifying questions as they talk. Open-ended questions are best, like the questions that begin with how or what, more than closed questions that require only a yes or no answer. Because here's the deal. A Scottish pastor from the late 1800s, John Watson, said it this way. He said, be kind to everyone you meet, for everyone is fighting a great battle. Even your greatest enemy, even someone that looks so confident and composed on social media. We're all little kids with wounds and insecurities and stuff we never got over from when we were 9. We live in a world of isolation and secrets. And most people want someone to come into their life and to listen to their story in a safe and non-judgmental way. And you may be shocked at the change that comes. There's an incredible man named Daryl Davis. Davis is a blues musician, but he also has what some might call an interesting hobby. For the past 30 years, Davis, a black man, has spent time befriending members of the Ku Klux Klan. He says, once the friendship blossoms, the Klansmen start to realize that their hate may be misguided. And since Davis started having these conversations with Klansmen, he says that 200 Klansmen have given up their robes. And when that happens, Davis just started collecting the robes, and he keeps them in his home as a reminder of the dent that he's made in racism by simply sitting down and having dinner with people. He says the key is that when two enemies are talking, it's a good sign, because that means they're not fighting. And when you spend 5 minutes with your worst enemy, he says, before long, you'll find you have something in common. And as you build on those commonalities, soon you're building a relationship. And after that, the relationship can actually become a friendship. And so he would sit down with these Klansmen and ask about their backgrounds. He'd ask about their beliefs, what led them into this organization. And over the years, Daryl Davis and hundreds of members of the Klan have become friends. And he says, I didn't convert anybody. They converted themselves. And if a blues musician can do it, I think the church can do it too. So here's my next step challenge this week. Will you identify a person to whom you will show compassionate curiosity this week? Maybe your spouse, maybe one of your kids, a coworker, or maybe an enemy. Will you slow down, lead with questions, and learn to listen? I believe it's the way of Jesus. And Grace Church, as we head into these deeply divided times, I believe that we can be a bright light in our community as we choose love over fear. I love you guys. God bless.